his On the Genealogy of Morals. Ressentiment, in Nietzsche's highly literary telling, is the process by which priests use their skills to redefine the culture's idea of what is virtuous in order to undermine the power of knights, i.e., the ruling nobility. The knights are non-intellectual men of action who hold more power than the priests, and the priests hate them for it. Thus, according to Nietzsche, Christianity elevated the meek and denigrated the powerful, just as Marx lionized labor and demonized entrepreneurs. It's much more complicated than that. Nietzsche always is. But Schumpeter took this framework and applied it to capitalism over time. There is one very common, if not quite universal, thing that unites these different kinds of priests. They tend to come from the ranks of the bourgeois and the very wealthy themselves. There's something about growing up prosperous that causes people not only to take prosperity for granted, but to resent the prosperous. It wasn't the children of auto workers who pulled up the paving stones on the left bank in 1968, writes Deirdre McCloskey. The most radical environmentalists and anti-globalists nowadays are socialist children of capitalist parents. The third component of Schumpeter's theory is that as capitalism creates more and more mass affluence, it creates more and more intellectuals until they become a new class. There have always been court intellectuals and artists, but until very recently, they made a living by working for the ruling class, which is why so much classical philosophical writing is esoteric. Criticism of the rulers had to be in code. As capitalism makes mass education possible, it creates a mass audience, a whole market, for what the intellectuals are selling. And what the intellectuals are selling is resentment of the way things are. This creates a much broader climate of hostility to the social order itself. For such an atmosphere to develop, Schumpeter writes, it is necessary that there be groups whose interest it is to work up and organize resentment, to nurse it, to voice it, and to lead it. One cannot watch cable television news, listen to talk radio, read a campus bulletin board about upcoming speakers, or listen to the preening, speechifying that comes with every Oscar and Emmy Award ceremony and not see that denigrating and undermining the established order is now not only a lucrative calling, but a major part of the culture. James Burnham, the former communist turned cold-eyed conservative, came to many of the same conclusions in his Managerial Revolution, What is Happening in the World, published in 1941, a year before Schumpeter's Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, albeit from a different perspective. By the time Burnham released Suicide of the West, an essay on the meaning and destiny of liberalism, in 1964, the new class thesis was widely debated across the ideological spectrum. Burnham argued that the overwhelmingly liberal, in the progressive sense, new class intellectuals weren't simply interested in power, but that they were motivated by guilt. He writes, "For Western civilization and the present condition of the world, the most important practical consequence of the guilt insisted in the liberal ideology and psyche is this, that the liberal and the group, nation, or civilization infected by liberal doctrine and values are morally disarmed before those whom the liberal regards as less well off than himself." I think guilt still plays an important role for some people, but I also think a half century later, guilt has mostly given way to anger. Many academics and writers no longer feel guilty about what Western civilization or America has done because they no longer feel like they belong to it. Many members of the new class today, particularly those called globalists, have a post-national attachment to their cosmopolitan class. They see themselves as citizens of the world, sharing more in common with their compatriots in London and Paris than with fellow citizens who sweep their floors, create small businesses, or simply feel a patriotic attachment to their own nation and culture. Both Schumpeter and especially Burnham were overly invested in their theory of capitalism's demise. George Orwell was deeply influenced by Burnham's writing on the new class, and that fascination was a major inspiration for his novel, 1984. But Orwell rightly rejected the idea that a managerial dystopia was inevitable. He astutely identified the problem in Burnham's worldview. Burnham was, in many ways, the kind of rationalist Schumpeter had identified. The moral and idealistic commitments that make liberal democracy possible were, for Burnham, an illusion. Everything boiled down to mere contests of power. Burnham, according to Orwell, believed that power can never be restrained by any ethical or religious code, but only by other power. The nearest possible approach to altruistic behavior is the perception by a ruling group that it will probably stay in power longer if it behaves decently. This obsession with power distorted Burnham's analysis of politics. Because power was everything, those in power would always remain in power. It will be seen, Orwell writes, that at each point Burnham is predicting a continuation of the thing that is happening. Now, the tendency to do this is not simply a bad habit, like inaccuracy or exaggeration, which one can correct by taking thought. It is a major mental disease, and its roots lie partly in cowardice and partly in the worship of power, which is not fully separable from cowardice. Orwell might be a bit too harsh, but he is ultimately correct. If those in power always win, then the miracle would never have happened. The kings of Europe would have crushed the bourgeois upstarts. Burnham was incredibly insightful about the way power really works in every society, but he failed to appreciate the way the founders had created a system that recognized the dangers of concentrated power. Schumpeter's analysis of social evolution is much more subtle and dynamic than Burnham's, taking into account the complex role psychology plays in every society. But Schumpeter suffered from the same conviction that events were evolving in an inevitable direction in accordance with a process ultimately beyond our control to stop. If Schumpeter and Burnham were right, the only intelligent course of action would be to surrender to the inevitability of it all and scurry to the right side of history. But as I argue in the first pages of this book, I reject that view. Fatalism, not Burnham's liberalism, is the real force driving the suicide of the West. Folding your hands in your lap and saying, "Let history take the wheel," is the fastest route to self-destruction. In other words, Schumpeter and Burnham might be right about capitalism's doom, but what will make that doom inevitable is taking their word for it. What they offer is not a prophecy, but a warning. And that warning is worth heeding. Taken as a warning, their analysis is incredibly valuable. It is true that a free society will create wealthy and influential classes or interests. And they are right that some of these groups will try to undermine a free society for their own benefit. The way those vested interests sabotage the engine of innovation is with words and ideas. And while they may not be succeeding as much as they would like, no observer of the current political and cultural scene can deny that they are constantly trying. But their victory is not inevitable. If it is true that the miracle was created by words, that means it can be destroyed by words. But it is also true that the miracle can be sustained by words. Our civilization, like every civilization, is a conversation. Therefore, the demise of our civilization is only inevitable if the people saying and arguing the right things stop talking. This works both ways. Every conflict ends when one side stops fighting. Usually we think of the loser as the one who accepts defeat. But the truth is, the battle can just as easily be lost if one side declares premature victory. In our own time, the most famous writer to be accused of that sin is the brilliant scholar Francis Fukuyama. As a young State Department intellectual, Fukuyama wrote a short essay for the National Interest titled The End of History, in which he argued that the fall of communism meant the debate over human organization had essentially been settled. What we may be witnessing is not just the end of the Cold War or the passing of a particular period of post-war history, but the end of history as such. That is, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. Fukuyama's argument has been widely misunderstood and caricatured. Despite his reliance on Hegelian philosophy, Fukuyama is less committed to teleology than he is to old-fashioned social science and history. He believed, and still believes, that liberal democratic capitalism is the best possible system for organizing society. The problem is that he took it for granted that the battle was over. His argument was much more plausible in 1989 than it is in 2018, as he has since conceded. The point here is that the defenders of the miracle can never get cocky. They can never lay down their rhetorical swords and retreat to their farms. All we can do is defend the principles and ideals that the miracle made possible in our lifetimes and hand off the project to our children. When we fail to do that, when we do not fill our children with gratitude for their inheritance, they will remain childish in their expectations of what politics and economics can accomplish. Simply put, cultures that do not cherish their best selves die by their own hand. We protect what we are grateful for. That which we resent, we leave out for the trash man, or let rot and decay in the elements, as the termites of human nature gnaw away at it. Ingratitude is the spirit that inebriates us with despair, and in our dark moments, makes suicide seem heroic. From whence shall we expect the approach of danger? Asked Abraham Lincoln. Shall some transatlantic military giant step the earth and crush us at a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe and Asia could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track on the Blue Ridge in the trial of 1,000 years. No, if destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we will live forever or die by suicide. 5. The eternal battle, reason versus the search for meaning. The history of political philosophy is really the history of the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. The two most important creation myths of the modern West were told by Locke and Rousseau. They are in constant battle with each other to this very day, and as of this writing, Rousseau is winning. In fact, for years, I've argued that almost every political argument boils down to Locke versus Rousseau. It's a staple riff of mine when I talk to college students. It goes something like this. Locke believed in the sovereignty of the individual and that we are all captains of ourselves. Rousseau argued that the group was more important than the individual and the general will was superior to the solitary conscience. Man is sinful, according to Locke, a noble savage, according to Rousseau. Our rights come from God, not from government, declares Locke. No, we surrender our individual rights to the judgment of the sovereign, replies Rousseau. Locke says that the right to property and to the fruits of our labors is the keystone of a free and just order. Rousseau says property is the original sin of civilization, and in a just society, property must be managed by the sovereign for the good of the whole community. Locke believes in equality before the law, but tolerates or celebrates inequality of wealth, merit, and virtue in civil society. Rousseau believes economic inequality is the source of all social ills, and that one of the most important tasks of government is to prevent extreme inequality of fortunes. Locke sees the formation of liberal governance as the greatest advance for mankind. Rousseau in the words of Michael Locke McClendon, sees the opposite. For Rousseau, Lockean freedoms secured through the social contract are nothing more than a ruse, a confidence trick the rich play on the poor to consolidate their power. Thus, modern humans are enslaved socially, economically, and politically. Look at almost any contemporary debate between the left and the right, and you will find echoes of this divide. Progressives take after Rousseau. Leftists insist, with varying degrees of intensity, that the rules of the game are nothing more than a rigged system of exploitative capitalism, white privilege, the patriarchy, etc. A unifying idea across the left is the Rousseauian idea that income inequality is a great evil, the defining challenge of our time, in the words of Barack Obama. The right argues for the other side of the coin. Donald Trump and some of a Randian bent cartoonishly insist that great wealth is a virtue unto itself. Conventional conservatives make a more sophisticated argument, emphasizing that freedom and merit will inevitably lead to economic inequality, and there's nothing wrong with that. The job of government, Speaker Paul Ryan likes to say, is to create opportunity for upward mobility, not to tell people you're stuck in your station. So here's a check to make life a little less miserable. I think this Locke versus Rousseau comparison illuminates a great deal, but it should be gripped lightly. There is a temptation common among intellectual historians and others who believe in the power of ideas to play a game of connect the dots. This is a tendency I definitely suffer from. A philosopher says X in 1800. Then, in 1900, a writer says something very similar to X. Ergo, the intellectuals conclude, the philosopher's influence spanned a century. This obviously does happen, a lot, but almost surely not nearly as much as intellectuals would like to believe. But the relationship between ideas, culture, and politics isn't incremental or linear, but catalytic and interactive. Westerners have wanted the Middle East to become variously Christian or liberal or democratic for centuries. If ideas alone had the power we sometimes ascribe to them, we could have just airdropped copies of the Federalist Papers or the Bible over Baghdad and Riyadh and waited for them to have the desired effect. The two most popular and closely related metaphors for ideas and their role in the world are light and flame. The Enlightenment, that great awakening of liberal political philosophy and scientific exploration, shed light on the world. Sometimes an idea is a spark that ignites some great fire or sets off a bomb. That's all fine, but no great fire can endure without the right fuel. No bomb can detonate if it's not made from the right materials. Ideas take root, another metaphor, only when the soil is right. And the nature of the soil changes the way an idea grows. Rousseau's psychological response to the Enlightenment led him to articulate a certain argument. But what links Rousseau to Bernie Sanders or Occupy Wall Street isn't primarily an intellectual lineage, but a psychological tendency. How many members of Occupy Wall Street or MSNBC pundits have read Rousseau's Discourse on Inequality? Of the fraction who read it, probably in college, how many of them can attribute their opposition to tax cuts or the Koch brothers to that text? The answer must be very close to zero. Likewise, how many Tea Partiers or Fox News contributors consult John Locke for their positions? The answer is the same. We tend to give too much credit to intellectuals for creating ideas. More often, they give voice to ideas or impulses that already exist as pre-rational commitments or attitudes. Other times, they distill opinions, sentiments, aspirations, and passions that already exist on the ground, and the distilled spirit is fed back to the people, and they become intoxicated by it. Revolutions die in the crib when the people are not inclined to be revolutionary. So just as the state is a myth agreed upon, most civilizational creation stories are just that, stories. That doesn't mean they are untrue. But the truth's significance is on a separate track from the significance of the story itself. It would be fair to say that John Locke was a storyteller who, more than anyone, created the miracle. But a more accurate way of saying it would be, the story we tell about Locke helped create the miracle. Born in 1632, in the small English village of Rington, Locke spent his childhood in the nearby market town of Pensford. His father, also John, a former soldier in the English Civil War, worked as a lawyer and clerk to a justice of the peace in a nearby village. The Locks, devout Puritans, were prosperous, but not particularly prominent. Thanks to his father's former commander, who was a member of Parliament, John received a scholarship to the Westminster School in London, where he excelled, winning placement at Christ Church in Oxford. He studied scholastic philosophy there, but was not particularly enamored with it. He spent more time studying medicine and science, then called natural philosophy. He stayed at Oxford for 15 years, from 1652 to 1667, in various administrative and teaching positions. In 1667, he moved to London, where he worked as a tutor and physician in the household of Anthony Ashley Cooper, who would become the first Earl of Shaftesbury. Cooper was a member of the Cabal that largely governed in England at the time of King Charles II. The term cabal has special meaning here. Normally, the king selected a single favorite counselor to advise and manage his rule. The so-called cabal ministry instead was made up of five privy counselors whose names, Clifford, Arlington, Buckingham, Ashley Cooper, and Lauderdale, spelled out the acronym Cabal. Through Shaftesbury, Locke procured several important administrative jobs in His Majesty's government. Shaftesbury, a leader of the Whigs, was one of the central political figures of his time, first siding with the Royalists in the English Civil War, but later switching to the parliamentary side. Whigs were united by three ideas. Parliament was supreme, Protestant minorities should be respected, and Catholicism was a threat to English liberty and sovereignty. The Whigs' anti-Catholicism, while regrettable, should not be viewed through the prism of the present day. In the 1600s, and well after in some quarters, Catholicism was deeply enmeshed with the power politics of the age. If Locke was a tutor to Shaftesbury's son, Shaftesbury was a father-like tutor to Locke in the realm of politics. It was during this time that Locke probably co-wrote, with Shaftesbury, the Fundamental Constitution of Carolina, the charter for colonial lands consisting of most of the territory between Virginia and Florida, of which Shaftesbury was one of the proprietors. In 1675, Locke moved to France for several years. When he returned, the politics of England were very different. Shaftesbury was now persona non grata with the crown, a leader in the effort to bar Catholics from the throne. This is relevant because Charles II, while not Catholic, was sympathetic to Catholicism. Indeed, Charles had once secretly promised the King of France to convert in exchange for support in his war against the Dutch. Worse, Charles's brother James was Catholic, and because the king had no legitimate sons, though plenty of illegitimate ones, James was next in line to the throne. That fact, combined with rumors of his dealings with the French, aroused a fierce backlash in Parliament amidst something of a national anti-Catholic panic in England, prompting the exclusion crisis from 1679 to 1681. Lord Shaftesbury led the Country Party, later called the Whigs, in the fight to legally ban a Catholic from wearing the crown. Charles repeatedly dissolved Parliament to fend off the effort. In 1681, Charles dissolved Parliament permanently until his death 4 years later. While Charles was still alive, however, Shaftesbury had been arrested and imprisoned in the Tower of London for high treason. Shaftesbury was acquitted by a grand jury, thanks to a weak case by the government and a jury hand-picked by a Whig sheriff. He tried unsuccessfully to organize an outright rebellion against the crown, but when that failed, He fled to exile in the Netherlands in the fall of 1682, lest he not be so lucky a second time. In January of 1683, he died in Amsterdam. It was against this backdrop that Locke wrote his two treatises of government, but he would not dare publish them for nearly a decade, lest he be put to death. In 1683, Locke also fled to the Netherlands. He did not return until after the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Recounting the story of the Glorious Revolution in detail would take us too far afield for our purposes. But a very brief summary is necessary. When Charles II died, his Catholic brother James inherited the throne. Again, English Protestants were convinced that Catholicism was a tyrannical creed that put the interests of foreign powers ahead of the interests of the English people. James set out to lift all of the legal prohibitions on Catholics in government. Worse, he attempted to transform Parliament, the seat of popular sovereignty, into a body of lackeys, lickspittles, and yes-men, reversing the progress of liberty in England and seeming to confirm the worst fears about Catholic absolutism. After all, France's king, Louis XIV, had spent much of the 1680s persecuting French Protestants, dismantling popular assemblies, and attempting to expand Catholic hegemony on the continent. There's a rough parallel between the 1680s and the 1930s, in that during both periods it seemed tyranny, by whatever label you want to put on it, was the wave of the future, not just in France, but in the Habsburg Empire and throughout much of Europe. Things came to a boil when James had a son with his second Catholic wife. This meant that the heir to the throne was no longer James's Protestant older daughter, Mary, but another Catholic. Mary's husband, William of Orange, the stadtholder or chief magistrate of the Netherlands, and James's nephew, organized an invasion for the purpose of regime change. He orchestrated an invitation from seven English lords to come to England. William put together an army of 25,000 men and an armada of 500 ships. His agents disseminated some 50,000 copies of a pamphlet vowing to seek a free parliament, i.e. one properly elected and not a tool of the king, the Catholics, or the French. After a daunting November Channel crossing, William's forces landed in Torbay in southwest England. There were two minor skirmishes, but James was inadequate to the task of rallying popular support, particularly at a time when anti-Catholic sentiment in England was so high. His foremost general, John Churchill, an ancestor of the 20th century prime minister, switched sides at enormous risk. Isolated and inept, James ordered his troops not to fight the invading army. He fled to France instead. But first, he did something remarkable and hugely significant. He took a sheaf of writs establishing a new parliament and burnt them. He then took the king's seal and hurled it into the Thames. This was not simply an act of spite. James believed, with some good reason, that if the official documents authorizing a parliament and the seal which legitimized that authority were disposed of, then no new government could be formed. Michael Barone writes in Our First Revolution, the remarkable British upheaval that inspired America's founding fathers, "We may think of official documents as readily fungible. If there's an original somewhere, or an act of Congress, or a Supreme Court decision, it is readily replicable, and its validity is not expunged if, by some unhappy accident, the original is consumed by fire or vermin. But in the 17th century, the document was the law." To the modern mind, this may seem almost comical. One can imagine the plot of some action movie in which the dastardly villains endeavor to find and destroy all the original copies of the U.S. Constitution, thus in one fell swoop eliminating the Bill of Rights in our system of government. But that's not how it works. That wasn't clear to James at the time. William marched into and occupied London, but he did not declare himself king. Rather, he called for new parliamentary elections and theatrically made no effort to sway them. The new parliament debated whether James was still king, decided that he was not, and named William and Mary the king and queen. The immediate political significance was obvious. There would never again be a Catholic on the throne. French influence on England was thwarted. A new Anglo-Dutch alliance was formed. But the lasting significance was far greater. Parliament, not God, had made William king. Moreover, it had established that Parliament was the ultimate authority in England and that the king was not above the law. This was a watershed moment. The idea of parliamentary supremacy, and hence the ultimate sovereignty of the people, had been around in some form since at least the days of the Magna Carta. Now the idea was manifested in the real world. The new parliament passed the English Bill of Rights, which cemented for all time the rights of parliament, never to be permanently dissolved again, the English people, and the limits on royal authority. No longer could the king or queen suspend laws, levy taxes, raise standing armies, and the like without the consent of Parliament. The right to free speech in Parliament was now beyond the power of the king to abrogate as well. It's crucial to understand how ideas and culture were intertwined in the Glorious Revolution. The new order was understood and ratified not as a radical departure from tradition and custom, but as a reassertion of it. In the text of the Bill of Rights itself, Parliament insisted that it was merely asserting and vindicating the ancient rights and liberties of the English people. In William's Declaration of Reasons for the Invasion, he hammered the point that he was merely trying to restore the English tradition of liberty and defeat the forces of tyranny and absolutism. He claimed to be unable to excuse ourselves from espousing their interest in a matter of so high consequence, and from contributing all that lies in us for the maintaining both the Protestant religion and the laws and liberties of these kingdoms, and for the securing to them the continual employment of all their right, and to come for no other design but to have a free and lawful parliament assembled as soon as possible. He was appearing upon this occasion in arms to rescue the Church of England and the ancient Constitution. In other words, the English culled from their past a story of themselves and ratified it in a legal principle. The story, not the principle, was what mattered most. But once committed to the story, new principles or ideas emerged that would eventually drive the story in new directions. Historians debate how sincere William was. To be sure, William had his own ambitions in mind, as did all of the Whigs and other members of Parliament, piously invoking the ancient customs of liberty as validation for a coup. Similarly, there was no end of realpolitik motivating the Dutch to pull off one of the greatest regime changes in human history. But what stuck was the story. Just as the Magna Carta became something more than a fairly mercenary, even grubby truce between the king and the nobles, the relatively bloodless Glorious Revolution reinforced the story the English told themselves about themselves. As Edmund Burke put it a century later, the revolution was made to preserve our ancient, indisputable laws and liberties, and that ancient constitution of government which is our only security for law and liberty. The Glorious Revolution simultaneously severed England from its feudal past, while at the same time grounding its new embryonic democratic society not in grand abstractions, but in a nationalistic, essentially tribal story of Englishness. The abstractions came later, and that is where John Locke came in. John Locke's Second Treatise, published in 1689, provided a philosophical binding for the pages of the story of English liberty. But it also contained within it a radical departure from English particularism. In tone and ambition, it spoke to the English heart and mind, but within it lay a universal worldview. I will offer a brief and somewhat selective summary, even though, spoiler alert, I will go on to argue that the precise details do not matter as much as some like to think. The second treatise on government contains its own creation myth. "Thus, in the beginning," Locke declared, "all the world was America." What Locke meant is that in our original tribal state, everyone lived like the Indians across the Atlantic. Why? Because no such thing as money was anywhere known. What Locke means by money here is property. And Locke's understanding of property is the key to his entire political worldview. Locke argues that in the state of nature, men exist in a state of perfect freedom to order their actions and dispose of their possessions and persons as they think fit, within the bounds of the law of nature, without asking leave or depending upon the will of any other man. Locke's state of nature is remarkably similar to Rousseau's in many respects. Locke says in the state of nature is a state also of equality, wherein all the power and jurisdiction is reciprocal, no one having more than another, there being nothing more evident than that creatures of the same species and rank, promiscuously born to all the same advantages of nature, and the use of the same faculties should also be equal one amongst another without subordination or subjection, unless the Lord and Master of them all should, by any manifest declaration of his will, set one above another and confer on him, by an evident and clear appointment, an undoubted right to dominion and sovereignty. For Locke, the problem with the state of nature is that it is unstable. It invites a state of war in which one man or group of men may use force to impose their will on another. Because the state of nature lacks a common judge with authority to settle disputes, disputes are therefore settled by force. The loser of such contests, if he survives but remains involuntarily under the control of the conqueror, is now in the perfect condition of slavery. This is an illegitimate or arbitrary use of force, for no man has the right to exert his will against another's will. That is because the first property right is the right to own yourself, and all other rights derive from this one. Thus, government is a necessary tool created collectively to protect property, which is another way of saying protecting life. Men, according to Locke, voluntarily combine to create government to do limited and specific things because our rights are prior to government. As we've seen, Locke was wrong about this in terms of history or anthropology, but Locke recognized what Mansur Olson meant when he said that order is the first blessing of the invisible hand. Long before Marx, Locke offered his own labor theory of value, or in Locke's case, a labor theory of property. For every man, Locke writes, the labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. Whatsoever then he removes out of the state that nature hath provided and left it in, he hath mixed his labor with and joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property. God gives us trees, but when a person chops down a tree and turns it into a table, it becomes property. Locke believed that property was the route to improvement. It was literally the vehicle of progress. The tribes of America might be exotic and fascinating, but it was nonetheless the case that a king of a large and fruitful territory there feeds, lodges, and is clad worse than a day laborer in England. In other words, Locke understood that human ingenuity creates wealth. For Locke, our inalienable rights were life, liberty, and property. The Declaration of Independence changed this to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But there is no insurmountable contradiction here, because Locke believed that property was the route to happiness. When the first man put a fence around a piece of land to cultivate it, he was beginning the process of human advancement, of culture. As we will see, this is the exact opposite of Rousseau's vision. Locke was interested not in material equality, but in equality in the eyes of God, and therefore in the eyes of government. People may have different perspectives and opinions, but that is because they have different experiences, and therefore tolerance for differences should be maximized. This is where Locke's doctrine of the blank slate, or in his case, blank paper, proved so useful. He writes, "Let us then suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. How comes it to be furnished? Whence comes it by that vast store which the busy and boundless fancy of man has painted on it with an almost endless variety? Whence has it all the materials of reason and knowledge? To this I answer in one word, from experience." This idea, which comes from Locke's work as one of the founders of empiricism, arguably did more to transform the world than anything he wrote on government and politics. As a matter of science, Locke was wrong. Obviously, experience informs and shapes how we see and understand the world. But we also come preloaded with all manner of genetic software that processes the data in various ways. But as a matter of politics and philosophy, Locke's rejection of original sin, innate ideas, and the natural, i.e. divine, authority of kings, moved politics from a God-centered universe to a man-centered universe. God was the only master of mankind, according to Locke, and no man could appropriate God's power. This meant that, in this world, each man was the master of himself, and just power had to be rooted in his consent. As Steven Pinker notes, one of Locke's targets was the then-dominant medieval understanding of human nature. Locke opposed dogmatic justifications for the political status quo, such as the authority of the church and the divine right of kings, which had been touted as self-evident truths, Pinker writes. The blank slate also undermined a hereditary royalty and aristocracy whose members could claim no innate wisdom or merit if their minds had started out as blank as everyone else's. It also spoke against the institution of slavery, because slaves could no longer be thought of as innately inferior or subservient. Locke's blank slate, in other words, was a part of a larger argument for pluralism, meritocracy, and tolerance. Locke elevated reason above revelation. He believed that man could reason his way through this world and create political structures based upon universal equality and consent. Since every person is furnished with like faculties, he wrote, and shared all in one community of nature, there cannot be supposed any such subordination among us that may authorize us to destroy one another as if we were made for one another's uses, as the inferior ranks of creatures are for ours. This idea was essentially a time bomb placed at the foundations of hereditary aristocracy, slavery, and the divine right of kings. Locke explicitly challenged the fixed hierarchical arrangements taken for granted almost everywhere 17th century Europeans lived, writes James T. Kloppenburg. Locke wanted the same rules applied to everyone. Promulgated established laws not to be varied in particular cases, but to have one rule for rich and poor, for the favorite at court and the countryman at plow. The rule of law that pays no heed to notions of inherited superiority was the ideal means to achieve the peace, safety, and public good of the people. This idea is the whole ballgame. We cannot police what is in the human heart, but only how people act on it. But freedom of men under government is having a standing rule to live by, common to everyone in the society in question and made by the legislative power erected in it, Locke writes. A liberty to follow my own will in all things, where the rule prescribes not, and not to be subject to the inconstant, uncertain, unknown, arbitrary will of another man. Many historians once argued that Locke's second treatise is less a standalone work of political philosophy and more of a political document intended to justify the Glorious Revolution. But it's clear that Locke wrote most of it well before the Glorious Revolution unfolded, and when doing so was an act of high treason. In the 1680s, even entertaining the idea that sovereign power resided in the English people rather than the king in Parliament put dissidents' lives in danger, writes Kloppenburg. Again, the causality here is important. The facts on the ground changed before the idea that legitimized the facts. The debate over whether the Second Treatise was primarily a political document or a philosophical one misses the key point. It was a cultural document, reflecting an idea whose time had come. John Locke saw the past as a pit humanity must labor to escape from. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, on the other hand, believed it was a shame we built the ladder at all. Whereas Locke saw the emergence of society as a story of liberation, not just of people, but of the mind, Rousseau saw modernity as a form of oppression. Rousseau was born in Geneva, Switzerland, the only society that rivaled ancient Sparta in Rousseau's mind as an ideal form of political organization. Rousseau's mother died shortly after giving birth to him. His father, Isaac, a grandiose and overeducated watchmaker who had married above his station, raised Jean-Jacques in Geneva until trouble with the law prompted the father to abandon his son, leaving Jean-Jacques to be raised by relatives who treated him poorly. At 16, the precocious Rousseau left for a life of adventure. In Savoy, Rousseau was taken in as steward to a rich, eccentric woman, the Baroness de Varennes. The fairly young baroness had left her husband, taking much of his money with her, and became a kind of eccentric adventurer herself. One of her vocations was as a Catholic missionary of sorts, specializing in converting young Protestant men. She served as Rousseau's patron and eventually his lover. By the time he left her employ, Rousseau, who had never been formally educated, was a full-blown man of letters and burgeoning philosopher. Eventually, he set off to Paris to make his mark, expecting to be recognized as a unique talent. When Rousseau arrived in Paris at the age of 30, the city was the intellectual capital of the world. He met Denis Diderot, another ambitious young intellectual who would go on to co-found and edit the Encyclopédie, the great compendium of the arts and sciences and the most important publication of the French Enlightenment. The two were the most prominent of the philosophes, the radical, anti-clerical, democratic intellectuals who laid much of the groundwork for the Age of Reason. Rousseau would go on to become more famous than Diderot and all the other philosophes. He was a true celebrity intellectual, admired by the royal court, for a time, as much for his brilliant writing as for his musical compositions and operas. Yet, he never seemed at home in Paris and eventually succumbed to severe feelings of alienation and self-loathing, writes Michael Locke McClendon. There's a reason for that. Rousseau was, to put a fine point on it, a miserable bastard. Rousseau was a cad, a showman, and a staggering and often heartless hypocrite. If you've ever seen the film Amadeus, he was surely less of a fool than Tom Hulce's Mozart, but he was just as contemptuous of social mores. He had numerous mistresses. In his own Confessions, he admitted that he had multiple children with one of them, a former scullery maid named Thérèse Levasseur. The man who said, "I know nothing which exercises a more powerful influence upon my heart than an act of courage performed at an opportune moment on behalf of the weak who are unjustly oppressed," nevertheless forced his mistress to give each of the children to an orphanage immediately upon birth. The man, who wrote some of the most influential and famous work on how to raise children properly, abandoned his own children. Rousseau seems a familiar type today. Indeed, he created the type, a celebrity intellectual who simultaneously yearned for ever more fame and controversy while heaping scorn on other intellectuals for their lack of integrity and concern with petty things. It should be no wonder that he was very much despised by many of the other leading thinkers of his age. "I have received your new book, Against the Human Race, and thank you for it," Voltaire wrote to him about Rousseau's social contract. "No one has ever been so witty as you are in trying to turn us into brutes," he said. "To read your book makes one long to go on all fours." Rousseau's feud with the English philosopher David Hume became an international drama. Hume had endeavored to help Rousseau find safety in exile in England. Rousseau repaid the kindness with bizarre accusations that Hume was the ringleader of some kind of elaborate plot against him. In a letter to his friend Adam Smith, Hume wrote of Rousseau, "Thus you see, he is a composition of whim, affectation, wickedness, vanity, and inquietude, with a very small, if any, ingredient of madness. The ruling qualities above mentioned, together with ingratitude, ferocity, and lying, I need not mention, eloquence and invention, form the whole of the composition." Rousseau had such a gift for personal ingratitude and public score settling that his life was a kind of literary reality show. In fact, that was probably the point. Rousseau, not constrained by conventional notions of honesty or integrity, would simply invent scandals and conflicts to stay in the public eye, a fact Denis Diderot had warned Hume about. Meanwhile, Diderot never took Rousseau's bait. In a letter to a friend seeking guidance about how to handle public scandal, Diderot wrote, "I am in control of my own happiness, and I challenge all the ingrates, scandalmongers, slanderers, envy-ridden scoundrels of the world to try taking it away from me." He was almost surely referring to Rousseau. In another letter, Diderot said of Rousseau, "I despise and I pity him. He is remorseful and shame pursues him. He is alone with himself. I am loved, esteemed, I'll even say honored by my fellow citizens and by strangers. The benefits held out by the great empress extend far and wide her renown, the praise of her actions and of my own. The news come to the traitor's ears. He bites his tongue with rage. His days are filled with sadness. His nights are restless. I sleep peacefully while he grieves. Perhaps he cries, tortures himself, and wastes away." In the debates about Rousseau, it is somewhat standard to reply that this amounts to argumentum ad hominem, an attempt to discredit an argument by attacking the person making it. But that's not my aim here. Rather, I think there's a deep connection between Rousseau's immoral behavior and his philosophy. I am not trying to say that his philosophy is simply a rationalization of his morality, though there is much of that in his Confessions. Rather, I think Rousseau's feelings of alienation from society, both fashionable and bourgeois, gave him a powerful visitor from Mars insight into the hypocrisies of the age. They also opened a hole in his soul, a hunger of the spirit. He believed that a disordered society created disordered souls. This disorder required a new society that harmonized the inner life of the soul with all social arrangements. It's as if Rousseau rejected the chastity and uprightness of his youthful Puritanism, but retained many of its theological assumptions. The world as we know it is corrupt. All middlemen between the individual and God distract us from the truth and the divine. Fittingly, Rousseau's conversion story to the new faith rivals Paul's story about finding God on the road to Damascus. At the age of 37, Rousseau walked to Vincennes to visit Diderot, who was in prison for criticizing the government. He walked because he couldn't afford the fare for a carriage. On his way, Rousseau stumbled upon a flyer for an essay competition sponsored by the Academy of Dijon. The topic? Has the progress of the sciences and arts done more to corrupt morals or improve them? The moment I had read this, he later recalled, I seemed to behold another world and became another man. The romantic spirit inhabited Rousseau. I felt my mind dazzled by a thousand lights. I felt my head seized by a dizziness that resembled intoxication. Rousseau claimed that he crumpled to the ground and fell into a kind of transcendent state. He awoke to find his coat drenched in tears. The reason for this effusion, writes Tim Blanning, was Rousseau's sudden insight that the Dijon Academy's question was not rhetorical. I suspect the records of the Academy would have disagreed. The question almost surely was intended to be rhetorical in the same way the organizers of an essay competition at Oberlin asking, has diversity made us stronger? Would simply assume the contest was over who would most creatively or loyally answer yes. Rousseau's essay, A Discourse on the Moral Effects of the Arts and Sciences, which won the contest, is the keystone for the entire cathedral of his thought. Rousseau turned the story of civilization on its head. All progress was really decay. All refinement was just a pleasant coat of paint hiding the corruption underneath. Civilization didn't liberate, it enslaved. Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains, as he would famously put it in The Social Contract. But the idea was already there in his discourse on the moral effects of the arts and sciences. He writes, so long as government and law provide for the security and well-being of men in their common life, the arts, literature, and the sciences, less despotic though perhaps more powerful, fling garlands of flowers over the chains which weigh them down. They stifle in men's breasts that sense of original liberty for which they seem to have been born, cause them to love their own slavery, and so make of them what is called a civilized people. The writings of Rousseau were all, in a sense, variations on the first sentence of his novel, Émile, or On Education. He wrote, everything is good as it leaves the hand of the author of things. Everything degenerates in the hands of man. Émile, he insisted, was nothing but a treatise on the original goodness of mankind. Like Locke, Rousseau bases his entire political philosophy on a fictional origin story of mankind, grounded in his doctrine of the noble savage, even though he never uses the term, which we've already discussed. Man is good. Man is solitary. Rousseau makes little mention of women. Man's biggest mistake was leaving the world of solitary self-sufficiency and selfishness and forming a society, because society is corrupt and takes us away from nature and man's natural state. Locke had complicated views on original sin, rejecting the view that Adam's fall carried to all mankind for all time. Like Rousseau, he believed there was no sin in a state of nature. But that was because the state of nature was lawless in the broadest conception possible. First with Jews and then Christians, man was blessed to receive moral laws from God, and thus defiance of those laws constituted sin. Rousseau sees it exactly the other way around. Recall what he wrote in Émile. Everything is good as it leaves the hands of the author of things. Everything degenerates in the hands of man. Locke sees man's ability to apply reason and labor to create artificial things, i.e. wealth and property, with his own hands as the heart of human progress. Rousseau sees artificiality as corrupting. Locke sees God's moral instruction as a blessing. Rousseau sees it as a corrupting curse. Indeed, Rousseau held that the moment man started down this path, the process of corruption had begun. In the most famous passage from the Discourse on Equality, Rousseau writes, "The first man who, having enclosed a piece of ground, bethought himself of saying, 'This is mine,' and found people simple enough to believe him, was the real founder of civil society."